Well, let me begin by saying what a pleasure it is to be back in Merton. I was a senior scholar here from 76 to 78, which seems like a very long time ago. In fact, it was a very long time ago. And this theatre wasn't here then, but it's really nice to be back. And I want to begin by saying how much I affirm and value the work of the GCU. I think that we do need Christians who are encouraged to think. And very often, I fear, you will have well-meaning pastors who will say, you know, don't think about this too much. And I would just like to begin on the critical note and say, please do think about things a lot, because you'll be engaging in dialogue with those who are thinking and are moving away from Christianity, and you can be the people who bring them back. So you need to bear that in mind. It's a gospel imperative, as Christ has said to us, you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And God has given you a mind, and it needs to be used. And I'm thrilled that we're going to explore something of this tonight. So I'm going to talk about Christianity and making sense of things. I'm going to talk about this for two reasons. One is because I think it's a very interesting topic. It means a lot to me. In fact, the capacity of the Christian faith to make sense of things is really the reason I ceased being an atheist and became a Christian. I began to realize that the Christian way of thinking, of looking at things, offered a luminous, an exciting, a credible way of making sense of things. And that drew me to faith back in 1971. Now, obviously, since then, I've moved on a bit, and I realized Christianity does rather more than just make sense of things. There are many other things about it as well. But for me, that was the door that led into it, and it remains important. But I do need to emphasize that there is far more to Christianity than that. And any decent attempt to do justice to the richness of Christianity would certainly include its ability to make sense of things, but would also include its ability to give you a moral framework, its capacity to construct an imaginative vision of reality which excites and informs. That's where C.S. Lewis, I think, is very good. And, of course, very important, it connects with the emotions and with real life. It's a big picture. And part of our walk of faith is to discover just how big and rich this picture is. And in many ways, that's the theme of this lecture tonight. Now, obviously, there are lots of areas I won't be able to cover, so I hope that in Q&A afterwards, you'll feel free to move this conversation in any direction you like. You don't need to limit your questions to what I'm talking about now, but you are welcome to pick up on anything if you'd like to. To see things afresh, to get a new vision of reality. That's always seemed to me to be one of the most exciting things about the Christian faith. It gives us a way of seeing things, which is not an invented way of seeing things, but actually is like uncovering them so that we see them perhaps for the first time. And very often what you really see, what is really there, is not what presents itself on the surface. And those of you who have been watching the news recently may just think of the words Jimmy Savile in bringing home the importance of that point. You see an external appearance, behind it there's something rather different. But in this lecture tonight, I want to begin by talking about the importance of seeing things. Those of you studying philosophy or the Western literary tradition will know that there is a long-standing tradition of seeing ocular imagery, sight, the eyes, as a metaphor for truth, to see things, to behold things. And that certainly is something that I'll be picking up tonight, because it's very much there in the New Testament. We see things, but simply looking at things doesn't necessarily mean we see them as they really are. And so what I want to do is begin to explore with you this whole theme of the Christian faith as a lens or a light or a map, which allows you to see things for what they really are. And when you see things for what they really are, that changes your attitude towards them. Now that's something of an abstract point. So I think it might be helpful if I try to give you an illustration to perhaps make more sense of it. And so I'm going to go to the southern English county of Dorset and to a place called Canford School. Canford School, no reason you should ever have heard of it unless you've been there. But for those of you who have not been there, it's a rather nice building, I have to say, down the south coast, which used to be a country estate and was converted into a school in 1923. What happened was the house was occupied by a distinguished British Assyriologist called Sir Henry Layard, who died without any heirs, left his house. In the end, it was bought up by a trust who converted it into Canford School. And they bought the buildings and everything in them, including a piece of stone, a rather large piece of stone. And nobody's really quite sure what to do with it. So it was used to prop open doors and perhaps at one point even to prop up the school dartboard. This piece of stone was seen as a bit of a nuisance. In 1993, an American professor of ancient history visited Canford School because he was writing a book about Layard. Layard, by the way, rediscovered Nineveh in 1847, so he's quite an interesting character in his own right. This man knew a few things, and he saw this stone in the school tuck shop, just beside the pizza counter. And he looked at it. He took the next train to London. He went to the British Museum. He came back a day later and informed the astonished school that this piece of stone was actually part of the panelling of the throne room of an unpronounceable Assyrian monarch of the 9th century BC. It was sold at auction a month later for $12 million. Now, that's a nice little story, especially if you're at Canford School, because it suddenly removed all its financial difficulties. But what I want you to do is just get into the picture. You're looking at a block of stone, you see it as a nuisance. It props up the school dartboard. Then you see it in a different way, but it's the way you ought to be seeing it, because this is what it actually is, as a precious piece of archaeological history, which is intrinsically valuable. You look at, but you don't necessarily see it for what it really is. And in many ways, that's one of the key themes I want to make in this lecture. That the Christian faith gives us a way of seeing things, life, nature, the world around us, which is what it really is, and invites us to readjust our estimations, our valuations, and our behaviour as a result. And that seems to me to be a very good theme for the GCU just to kick off with on this very first meeting of its term. And it means that we need to really begin to explore our faith, discovering not simply what Christianity is all about, why it might be right, but the difference that it makes to the way in which we think, the way in which we see things, and of course, the way in which we behave. And I want to reassure you, this is actually a very good thing to do, which will lead to an enrichment of your faith and a deeper appreciation of just how significant your faith is. It's all about intellectual exploration. One of the best novels about Oxford is Brideshead Revisited. It describes a rather decadent period in Oxford's history, which I'm sure is now behind us, back in the 1920s. And as you all know, it's written by Evelyn Waugh, who was, as we'd say in Ireland, was a bit of a lad. In 1930, Waugh, having established a reputation as a somewhat colourful character and a very avant-garde novelist, stunned the world by announcing he converted to Christianity. It made the front pages of the Daily Express. So it gives you an idea of very different times back then. And in a letter he later wrote to a friend, he talked about the difference that coming to faith made. I want to read these words to you because I think they are very interesting. Conversion, he wrote, is like stepping across the chimney piece out of a looking glass world. That's very 1920s English. Where everything is an absurd caricature into the real world God made. And then begins the delicious process of exploring it limitlessly. And you can see the point he's making, two points actually. Number one, the world of shadows and caricatures, leave it behind into the real world, things as they really are. And then begins the process of exploring it limitlessly. What I want to say to you tonight is that that's part of your journey of faith, exploring your faith. making connections, especially if I might say so, with the subject that you're studying? Is there some connection there that might be significant for you that might need further unpacking? I think there is. Or your future professional calling, whatever that is, how are you going to make connections between your faith and that? It does seem to me to be very important. And therefore, what I'm going to do, if I may, is offer three images, three metaphors, I think, which help us as we begin to reflect on how our faith looks at things. Now, they are simply, first of all, a map, secondly, a lens, and thirdly, a light. And I emphasise these are simply organising categories to help us get a sense of what's going on here and begin to develop strategies for looking at things. Let's begin by thinking about a map. It's a favourite image in Christian apologetics. C.S. Lewis, as many of you will know, uses it in his book Mere Christianity. And the point that Lewis is trying to make there is very, very simple. There is a landscape, a rich landscape, which needs to be investigated and explored. And remember, Lewis himself came to faith and began to appreciate the richness of this landscape. And again, if I could just make a little side point, especially those of you who are studying literature. Lewis became a Christian not accidentally because he happened to be reading literature, but because literature proved the gateway to faith. He noted that writers like Thomas Traherne and George Herbert seemed to offer a much more realistic and coherent account of reality than people like, number of people in the 1920s who he begins to single out, like George Bernard Shaw and others. And he noticed this deepened quality of representation and began to realise this might reflect their underlying worldview as being more reliable. But Lewis, in effect, uses this image of a map. And he makes the point very, very clearly. A map is simply a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional reality. And again, you might think about this if you're going to explore Italy or wherever. There is going to be a massive discontinuity between this piece of paper and the brilliant landscapes you're looking at. The paper isn't the reality, but the paper nonetheless gives you an idea of what's there, how to get there. It sets you an agenda for exploration. It, in effect, is mapping out the territory and saying you have all of this to discover. And in many ways, that is what the Christian faith is doing. Most of us, I certainly speak for myself as a young Christian, feel we know this bit quite well. For me, sense-making. But I was aware that there was a bigger map and there were vast areas that were really unknown territory for me that needed to be explored. In other words, you can think of the Christian faith as giving you an invitation to explore. You feel confident about this, but there is this to explore. What I want to suggest to you is that exploring that landscape of faith is really very significant as a means of deepening our faith and appreciating its ability to be able to interact with things. You think of the creeds as a kind of checklist of important bits of our faith. And what is interesting, I think, is that very often some of us will recite the creeds and say, well, that's a really important bit. And there are these things as well, which, why are they there? But actually they're there because they are things that are actually quite important but may take you some time to begin to engage them. Over the summer, I had a very interesting conversation with a group of people at Oxford. It was a little summer school. And people were talking about their faith. So I asked them two questions. There are about a dozen of them. I said, tell me what drew you to faith. Now, eight of them had come to faith. So they talked about what brought them to their faith. And they were very interesting. It makes sense of things. It makes me feel loved. It gives me a moral framework. And imagine the kind of things they said. I then asked them, what is it that now excites you about the Christian faith? In other words, you've moved on. What excites you now? For one of them, the first thing which drew them still excited them. But for others, They had discovered new aspects of faith. They hadn't lost sight of the thing that drew them in. That was still important. But they found something else that was now the thing that really made their pulses beat a little quicker. Now, I want to suggest to you that's part of our walk of faith. Opening up the new territories which are there. Seeing what's there. And asking how this is something that can enrich and develop our faith. The second image I want to look at is the image of a lens. The image of a lens is about bringing things into focus. Now again, I just want you to do a little mental experiment where you... Well, let's imagine you're taking a picture of Merton College, which of course is a splendid college, and you haven't got autofocus, you kind of are trying to get the lens right, and everything seems blurred, and then you get it right, and things come into sharp focus. It's a very powerful image. Because one of the things the Christian faith does is to say, look, things may look blurry and fuzzy, but actually, you can sharpen this up. You can bring things into focus. The Christian faith gives you a lens which makes sense of things that are otherwise puzzling. Richard Dawkins and I have argued about quite a few things. One of the things I keep saying to him is that he has a lens which simply is unable to explain why anybody would want to believe in God. His only answer is they're deluded or they're mad or they're bad or they're sad or possibly all four. I have to say to him that actually that is a very inadequate lens for viewing reality. The Christian lens was what brought me to faith, because in effect I saw things with a clarity that I had never seen before. And that's what Lewis found. Again, read Surprised by Joy, and we'll see how that theme begins to bubble up halfway through and then bubble up again at the end. It's very important for him, and it is also for us. Christianity, if you like, gives us a lens or a window through which we can look and see things as they really are. And that, I think, is important. Let me give you a few lines from George Herbert, because Lewis liked him very, very much, and he is a good writer. This is from one of his poems, which I think all of you will know, but just listen to these lines. A man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth, through it pass, and then the heaven spy. Now what's that all about? Well, there are lots of things could be said, but the thing I'm saying tonight is simply this. Herbert is asking us to think of two different ways of looking. Looking at, looking through. I'm a theologian, so I enjoy looking at Christian doctrines. How they developed, how they linked together. It's very interesting. But Herbert is saying, actually, you need to look through these. In other words, you need to ask what way of looking at reality, looking at nature, looking at myself, at you, does the Christian faith make possible? And again, you can see that, for example, in all of Paul's letter. Think of Philippians 2, where he encourages people to think of others as being better than themselves, because that is the way you should do it in the light of Christ's incarnation. The point that Herbert is making is you can look at the Christian faith, you can look through it. And most of us begin our walk of faith by looking at, and somehow forget to get round to looking through. What way of thinking, of living, does our faith make possible? There's a window there, you could look at it, and it looks tolerably interesting, but actually what's really interesting is what's on the other side of it. And the lens, the window, makes that possible. And that seems to me to be a very important theme. It's all about Christianity enabling you to see that there is a big picture, not an incoherent walk which takes you nowhere, but rather something that makes sense. There is this panorama, and we're invited not simply to enjoy it, but to explore it and inhabit it as well. And that theme of a big picture is just so important. You can use the language of meta-narratives or whatever you want, but it's basically that there is a bigger picture, that each of us is part of a bigger story, and that finding how our own individual story connects up with this bigger story of God's dealings with humanity in history, culminating in Christ, is a very important part of it. God's story is ongoing, so is yours. How do you fit into that bigger story? It's a very significant question, and one certainly I'd want to encourage you to explore. The third image is that of light. Very important theme throughout Scripture, especially the Old Testament. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Dominus illuminatio mea et salus mea. The Lord is my light, the motto of this university. It's a very powerful image. If you think about light, there are a number of ideas that probably come to your mind. Most importantly, I think, probably two. Light enables us to see things clearly. Secondly, light shows up things for what they really are. Let's look at each of those. Let me give you what I'm afraid is my favourite quote from C.S. Lewis. It's from his paper, Is Theology Poetry?, given at the Socratic Club here in Oxford in 1943. The paper as a whole is actually very interesting and very good. His answer really boils down to, you know, what you think theology is and what you think poetry is. But the last line of the essay goes like this. I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. And what Lewis is saying there is the Christian faith, if you like, illuminates reality. It lets you see into the shadowlands. It gives you a brighter vision of the way things really are. It makes sense. That's very important. I'll come back to that. But there's a second theme. It shows things up for what they really are. I began my academic life at Oxford Wadham College. In my second year at Wadham, I was given a lovely old room in the oldest part of the college, one of the houses on Holywell. And in fact, I walked past it tonight on my way here. And at night, this room looked wonderful. It was so atmospheric. It had really old walls. They looked really romantic. In the daylight, when the sunlight streamed into the windows, you could see the walls actually were crumbling. And you could see the carpet, you know, clearly went back as long as Wadham did and needed urgent replacing. And, you know, on the whole, I tended to work in the labs during daylight hours and come back in the evening. It was more interesting then. But, you know, light shows up things for what they really are, and that is not always comfortable. It destroys illusions. Some of these are illusions that we find quite easy to deal with. Others are more difficult because it illuminates each of us and asks us to realize that there is remedial work that needs to be done. And actually, very often it's work that we can't do ourselves. It has to be done by God as the one who heals. But nevertheless, it's uncomfortable, because it allows us to realize we have to do something. So if I was giving a talk on spirituality, I'd major on that. But because I'm talking about making sense of things, I'm going to look at the first of these. The idea of being able to make sense of things in a way that otherwise wouldn't be possible. My own background is the sciences. And for me, there are a number of questions that emerge from natural sciences which are actually quite difficult to answer. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why is it that the human mind is able to make such sense of things? Or, to put this more precisely, if mathematics is the free creation of the human mind, why is it that mathematics gives such a good description of what we actually observe in the real world? And there are lots of these enigmas all over the place. The point I want to make simply is this. If you take a Christian way of looking at things, these enigmas actually aren't enigmas anymore. That they just are what you would expect. And here's the point I'm going to emphasise, because it is really very important. We tend to look at the snapshots of Christian faith rather than the panorama. What do I mean by that? We tend to think about incarnation or creation or redemption. These are all good things to think about. But what is even more important is the big picture that results from putting all of these together. And what I discovered at quite an early age was that the Christian faith gives you this big picture, which in effect says, look, you see that? That's what you'd expect if Christianity were right. It gives you a way of seeing things. And again, many will have read the writings of G.K. Chesterton. And there's a wonderful essay of his from 1903 in which he talks about some of the reasons why he came back to faith. And the point he made was that he suddenly realized that if Christianity were right, then it made sense of the world, his own experience, and of history. In effect, he says, when I look at the world through Christian eyes, it becomes transparent. In other words, things fit into place. Now, clearly, there's some things that don't fit into place. And if I had time, I would talk about some of those. Suffering would be a very good example. But the point I want to make is that even the shadowlands are illuminated by our faith. And that, I think, is something that's very important. And I'll be able to come back to that, I hope, later in this lecture. Here is what Chesterton had to say. Again, it's an article of 1903. Numbers of us have returned to this belief, and we've returned to it because the theory, when it's adopted, works out everywhere. It's like a coat, when it is tried on, fits in every crease. We put on the theory like a magic hat, and history becomes translucent like a house of glass. And he wrote works like The Everlasting Man, which, as many of you will know, helped C.S. Lewis to come to faith. So what I'm saying to you is that the ability of Christianity to light things up, whether we're looking at our own internal intuitions, the world around us, literature, science, whatever it is, it makes sense. Better sense than anything else. When I was young, I was an atheist. I have to say I was quite an aggressive atheist. In fact, sometimes when I read Richard Dawkins, I do feel a bit nostalgic, because I used to be that way too. But the breakthrough for me came when I realised that actually atheism didn't actually make all that much sense. And as I began to talk to Christian friends and read Christian books, I began to realise Christianity made rather more sense. And I began to realise this insight, which has remained with me ever since, that the ability of something to make sense of things doesn't prove it's right, but it certainly suggests there's something here worth looking at very seriously. All the authors I've quoted tonight have been male. To remedy the balance, here's Simone Weil, who became a Christian and talked about the difference her faith made. If I light an electric torch at night out of doors, I don't judge its power by looking at the bulb, but by seeing how many objects it lights up. The value of a spiritual way of life is appreciated by the amount of illumination thrown on the things of this world. I would suggest that's helpful. That in effect it's all about realizing that if Christianity is right, it's not just about, you know, saving me, though it is, but it's also about seeing things in a new way, a way that makes sense for us, but which also we can explain and defend to our friends. I think Christian apologetics is very important. Apologetics basically is giving reasons for faith, trying to engage with the concerns our culture has about faith. And what I find is that very often one of the best ways of doing apologetics is to say to somebody, well, look, that's how you see it. Now, try stepping into my way of seeing things. Doesn't that seem to work a lot better? And might the reason it works better be that actually it might be right? In other words, trying to begin to plant in people's minds the idea that the Christian faith actually might not just be about personal transformation, but about a different way of understanding and acting within the world. It's a very biblical theme. I'm sure as I've been talking, you've been thinking of many biblical passages. The one that stands out for me is Romans 12, verses 1 to 2, where Paul talks about not being conformed to the world, but about being transformed through the renewal of our minds. The transformation that the gospel brings about in our lives includes seeing things in a Christian way, not simply passively echoing what we pick up from the world around us. So I've been exploring these themes. I'm going to wrap up in a moment to give you time to ask lots of questions. But I would, I think, want to look at one thing, which I think really is important. The kind of vision of Christianity that I've set out before you tonight is unremarkable. You will find it in most major Christian writers, especially those here in Oxford. I've mentioned Lewis, very much an Oxford man. You might think of J.R. Tolkien, also an Oxford man. There are others who really are able to stimulate your thinking. And I want to suggest to you that one of the things you can do during your time here is engage writers like that, who will, if you like, be your dialogue partners or your partners along the way as you think about these things. They may not be right all the time, but they will nevertheless help you to think these things through. Reading literature, what other Christians have written, can be enormously important in enriching your vision, even if it's by disagreeing with them, saying, no, 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 this is better than what they've got. That is helpful. It's about deepening and expanding your vision of faith. But I want, if I may, to end with a quote from C.S. Lewis's essay, written towards the end of his life, An Experiment in Criticism, where he talks about a number of things, and one of them is the importance of reading good literature. And he says, look, my own eyes are not good enough for me. I will see through the eyes of others. I remain who I am, but I'm able to see things in all these ways by reading literature. What I want to suggest is that your sight at the moment is probably pretty good, but it could become better. And one of the ways in which you can enrich your vision of faith is by reading, engaging, reflecting, thinking, deepening your own grasp of faith, which will A, help you appreciate all the more, but will B, help you explain and defend it in the coffee house, in the lecture theatre, wherever people want to raise these issues. The new atheism, which I think is now beginning to fade, but certainly it's still around a little bit, but the new atheism has generated an interest in the God question. And people are not really very happy with the answers they've given. They're looking for better answers. And I think you people here tonight could give some very good answers and could give even better answers by doing the kind of thing I've been exploring in this lecture. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Thank you so much. And Professor McGrath has graciously agreed to stick around and answer questions for the next half hour or so. So as he said, the floor is wide open, and please stick your hand up. So I see one way back here.
Yes, you mentioned that you were converted from atheism to Christianity. Why Christianity and some other religious worldview based on emotional revelation?
I think that one of the things I've emphasized in this lecture is that the ability of a worldview to make sense of things is very important. And I have to say very, very frankly that the Christian way of looking at things is quite distinct. It's emphasis on incarnation. I see no direct parallel elsewhere. And it wasn't so much, you know, individual Christian doctrines that appealed to me more than what I found in Judaism or something like that. It was much more this big picture, the panorama. And that really, I think, was what drew me in. This recognition that the Christian faith gave this big picture, which was intellectually comprehensive but spiritually resilient. And that really drew me in and made me want to explore. Thank you. I think I find the answer to that question in the writings of Iris Murdoch, who again was an Oxford philosopher based at St. Anne's. And Murdoch is talking about, she's talking particularly about justice. And I'm looking at her well-known Romanus lecture, The Sovereignty of Good. And in that, she's talking about, in effect, the need for something that defines what is good, which is not simply human convention and not simply the self-pursuit of, you know, our own interests. And she reflects on this, and she is an atheist, but in effect she's a kind of atheist who is saying, you know, that we need an awful lot of thinking about this, because she makes the point very, very rigorously that unless you have a transcendent vision of the good, then you have something that is fluctuating, that is unstable, that can be manipulated by power groups. In short, it is unusable. And so actually she almost goes back to Plato, you know, and says that whether we like it or not, that or something very like it is right and necessary. And then she just makes the point that actually Christians believe something very much like this, and it's to their credit, because they've recognized that this is the way things have to be if we're to lead a livable life. So that does seem to me to be really very important. Now, as an atheist myself, I think one of the reasons I thought atheism was right was something like this. This is so bleak and austere that nobody's going to want to believe this. Therefore, the fact that I believe it when it's so unattractive is an indication of its truth. And I think that is a sort of view I very often find in some public atheist writers who seem to say, look, you know, you guys are looking for something that satisfies or that will give you purpose, but these are just illusions. I'm saying there is no satisfaction, there is no purpose, just, you know, get used to it and buy into it. I don't really find that very persuasive. To me, I think that the main point I'd want to make is that atheism really, in effect, consists mainly of a denial, which, you know, I can understand, but it leaves me wondering what else there is in that picture. I look for a big picture and I see, in effect, a big picture with everything greyed out. And it really just seems to me that it's a one-trick pony. One of the interesting things you can look at is the way in which the New Atheist movement is actually fragmenting quite radically at the moment. And the reason it's doing so is because, in effect, they said, right, okay, we've all agreed there's no God. Now, what do we talk about next? I know, we'll talk about the place of women, or we'll talk about the nature of good. And there is no agreement within the movement. So it's very interesting the way in which, when there is a pressing issue that is clearly something of landmark importance, people will gather around that. When you move on to talk about other things, actually you find that the consensus disappears very, very quickly. So I have to give a longer answer to a question, but that's certainly how I begin that answer. Thank you.
Yeah. Professor, you mentioned in one of your books about the importance of evangelism for Christianity, future Christianity. I wonder how you see that in regard to the trend about interfaith. I don't mean interdenomination, interfaith dialogue. How do they relate to each other? Can you be a good evangelist and
do you mean an evangelist or an evangelical?
They're just
evangelical. They're just slightly different ideas. I think that when I look around contemporary evangelicalism, I see a range of positions. I regret to say, because he is no longer with us, John Stott. I see a model of personal graciousness and theological integrity. I see others who I've no doubt are models of theological integrity, but they kind of don't have the personal graciousness that John Stott did. I think in dialoguing with other faiths, graciousness, winsomeness, Humility is extremely important. And there is nothing that turns people off Christianity more than arrogant and bombastic people. I need to make that point very, very clearly. But there is nothing whatsoever that stops you being gracious and truthful, that stops you trying to understand, while at the same time saying, let me explain and proclaim. And what I found in my own dialogue with those of other faiths, and none I have to say, is that when I listen very carefully, attentively, what they have to say, that does give me the moral right to ask that they listen to what I have to say. And I think that in the end, your question is very, very good. In the end, the answer is going to depend on whether you personally, as I do, think that Christianity is right. Because if it's not, you'll find that out very quickly. And for me, one of the great joys of doing precisely what you've been asking about is that actually very often it just helps me to rediscover why this big picture that Christianity gives is so satisfying and so resilient. Because one of the questions you have to ask of any worldview is this: if I am right, how do I account for the fact that not everyone thinks this is right? Atheism's answer, Richard Dawkins' answer, is, well, you're deluded, you're fools, you haven't yet woken up, you haven't yet turned the on switch in your brain. Christianity offers a very compelling explanation of why people might not believe in this, which is gracious, perceptive, and I think fundamentally right. And actually I find that that very often opens up some very important dialogues and conversations. So I just want to say that it is important to be gracious, it is important to listen, but it's also important to speak and to realise there are very important things that can be said, there are seeds that can be planted, and some very important conversations that can move things ahead. Thank you for that.
Hi. You focused on Christianity allowing you to see things, which I agree with. I myself am also doing scientific research, and modern day science allows us to also to see things in the world in a very convincing and technical way. So could you talk a little bit about how you either contrast that or use that with your Christian lens?
Thank you. That's a very perceptive question. I think what I'd want to say is this. This is an absolutely classic piece of Christian theology. It goes back to Aquinas in the 13th century, and you'll find endless writers repeating it today, like John Polkinghorne, but it's good. In effect, it is saying, look, Christianity gives you, my phrase, big picture, you can think of a different picture if you want to, but gives us this way of thinking which presents an ordered universe, which in some way reflects the mind of God, which is open to investigation, whose rationality can be comprehended because it is the product of a rational God who has created us bearing his image and therefore at least with some ability to grasp the rationality of this universe and work out where it takes us. And you think of Romans 1, where Paul in fact is saying, look, you look at the world, look at the universe, and you begin to think thoughts about where this all takes us. I think that's a very important line of argument. But your question is good because it just takes us a little bit deeper, which is, look, there's a scientific way of thinking, there's this Christian way of thinking. How do these kind of way go together? Or are they like watertight compartments that just don't interconnect? They do interconnect, but it's not as if I'm saying that Christianity displaces science. Christianity creates conceptual space for science, and that's very important. But science has its limits. I think that's a very important point. Again, this is where Richard Dawkins and I would disagree very strongly, I think. Dawkins would say, so science can't explain it today. Well, we're working on it. We'll be able to explain it tomorrow or day after. I'm not sure about that, and most scientists aren't either. I think, Peter Medawar is a very good example, an Oxford scientist, Nobel Prize in immunology, medicine for his immunological work back in 1961, I think it was. He wrote a very famous book at the end of his life called The Limits of Science. And what he was saying is, look, science is great within limits, and the minute you trespass beyond those limits, you're in deep trouble. And he singled out what Karl Popper calls ultimate questions. Why are we here? What's the point of life? Where do we get values from? And actually, science doesn't really answer those questions. But I want to say to you that actually, like for example, what is the good life and how do we lead it? That's rather an important question. And if science can't answer it, it's not going to stop me asking, how do we find the good life and lead it? And what I'm saying to you is that Christianity gives you this big picture, which allows you to put a big tick beside the sciences and say that they're doing some good stuff, providing they recognize their limits. But Christianity is able to go where science doesn't go, like questions of purpose or agency or value. And that does seem to me to be terribly important. And again, I've criticized Richard Dawkins a lot tonight. He and I agree on one thing. There's his book, The Devil's Chaplain, 2003, where he says, science has no means of telling us what is ethical. Now, I think he's right. The implications of that are massive. Because you look at banking, you look at, well, wherever in this world, and ethics are big. Science doesn't really take you there. But Christianity gives you science and gives you a moral framework as well. So that's just the beginnings of an answer, but you can see I'm sketching a map which hopefully will benefit from further exploration. Thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate what you're saying about Christianity giving us the big picture. But I was also wondering, that could also be true of deism. It's also possibly true of theism. But with Christianity, you've got this, what some people have called the scandal of particularity, the fact you've got this carpenter from the Near East, and that it's focused on that. Could you talk about maybe something about that?
Yes, certainly.
Making sense of it,
Well, deism was really invented in the late 17th century as a way of, in effect, producing a generic concept of religion, which everyone could buy into, so there wouldn't be any more religious infighting. And so it's a sort of synthetic form of religion in many ways. But that's just a historical observation. The point you're making is very important. This scandal of particularity. Above all, the emphasis on Jesus Christ, and especially the doctrine of the Incarnation. The phrase, the scandal of particularity, I think goes back to Lessing in 1768. And you've got to bear in mind that he is writing within an Enlightenment context. Reason can explain everything. Therefore, anything that is not universal, necessary, and clear, the three cardinal criteria of true knowledge according to Enlightenment, has to be regarded as unacceptable. Now, really, the way I criticize, the way I respond to your question is not by, in effect, defending the particularity of Christianity, although I'm going to do that in a minute, but actually I want to begin by criticizing the false universality of the Enlightenment, by saying it articulates a vision, a big picture, if you like, which just doesn't work. And we all know that now. I mean, if you look at Isaiah Berlin's work here in Oxford, he simply makes the point that actually you can't sustain that because the historical evidence is so clear. People have thought in different ways at different times. If you want to bring Karl Marx in, which I think we ought to, he would say that actually a lot of ideas are sociologically determined. You know, it's a very complex matter. And we need to realise that Lessing was writing at a time when people were uncritical about reason. We're not anymore. So that's the first point. Second point. Yes, Christianity does have a particularity, a specificity, which many find scandalous. After all, Paul does talk about this being a bit of a stumbling block. It's a stumbling block because it is subversive of a whole series of ideas which many just take for granted. But you think of what Christianity is saying. God has entered into history. He's come to the place where we live. He's in effect made it possible for us to go where he is by coming where we are. And most theologians simply make the point that this specificity, a God who enters into history, who tells us who he is and what he's like, who makes it possible for us to be with him, actually may well be scandalous in one sense. But if it's right, it just changes the game altogether. And so what I want to say is, A, particularity isn't quite the problem that we think. That's why, you know, I'm reluctant to criticize postmodernity too much because it does make some important points. And the critique of the Enlightenment universality is a very important part of that. But also, there is something about Christianity which, yes, does raise people's hackles, as it did in the New Testament itself. But if it is right, it's a game changer. And that's one of the reasons why I want to say, yes, Christianity is saying there is this historically specific component, but it has universal relevance. Not as if salvation is limited to those who were physically contiguous with the lifetime of Jesus Christ. No, this is about a divine entry into history, which is universally significant, so that you and I benefit from it, even though we weren't there at the time. So I'm going to say some things which do help set that in a helpful context. Thank you.
And I know this isn't your particular area of science that you study, but do you believe human consciousness is a simple byproduct of the evolutionary process?
It's not my particular area, and therefore I will answer your question because I've thought about it, but I must emphasize that it's not something I feel totally confident about, and therefore I must ask you to treat this simply as an interested observer's perspectives. I claim no competence in this area. I think that evolution psychology is raising lots of interesting questions. And if you read some secular interpreters of evolution psychology, Daniel Dennett would be a very good example. He tends to argue something like this. Well, evolution psychology gives us an evolutionary explanation for why we think like this. Because we can explain it, we can therefore somehow devalue or discredit or discount it. And I think my concern is not so much evolution psychology offering an explanation for this. And if I give you a very simple example, Christians have always known that we have an inbuilt desire for God. If evolution psychologists want to give us a mechanism by which it arose, well, fine, but you know, it doesn't negate the reality. And in debate with Daniel Dennett, I made this point, which I think is a good point. Supposing we could show that the human quest for truth was simply an outcome of the evolutionary process, would that invalidate it? Well, no. And actually, that is a very good example of the whole debate about whether naturalism ultimately is self-defeating. Now, that's a bigger debate than the one you've just mentioned, but it is quite important. Because one of the points, like for example, Alvin Plantinga makes this point very much in a recent book looking at naturalism, he would simply say that in the end, if we say that human reason, slightly different emphasis than yours, but human reason is simply a byproduct of the evolutionary process, does that mean then we are using precisely that byproduct to evaluate everything? In other words, is the tool that we are using to draw that conclusion and do things with it invalidated by the origins according to the usage of that tool? Which is the point I'm trying to make. So there are some very interesting questions to follow through there. As I say, I don't feel completely comfortable in engaging the question, but there are others who have, and Alvin Plantinga's recent book, I think, is a great starting point. Thank you. I'm sorry, the microphone seems to have gone dead. But as long as you can hear me.
Okay. Or I think the one on the
screen
might be on.
Okay. Right.
Thank you for your talk, Professor McGrath. I had a question. You spoke about, you spoke in the language of seeing and vision. It seems that the Bible talks quite a lot in terms of hearing. Hearing the word of God, hear, O Israel, hearing the good news. Would that be just another way to talk about Christianity as a matter of hearing?
Yes, I do like that question.
Would one be better than the other?
They're different. Let me talk about that, because it really is a very good question. There is no doubt that the Western philosophical tradition has privileged ocular metaphors. Seeing, sight, lenses. You know, you think of the way in which George Herbert uses the image of glass, for example. And writers like Martin Heidegger, you know, have simply said, this is the way it is, and they've actually offered some interesting, but I think ultimately unpersuasive accounts of why this is. There's another tradition which emphasizes the auditory hearing, and part of that is in the New Testament. You know, faith comes by hearing. You know, it's a very important theme, and you will not be surprised to know that auditory metaphors are very important for Luther and Calvin, who see themselves in effect as picking up some Pauline themes, and hearing the word of God is very important for them. So the answer is, clearly, there are these two different ways. Now, are they radically divergent or are they potentially reconcilable? I think they're reconcilable. They make different points. Let's pick up on auditory images because I think actually that they are very, very significant. One of the points that cultural historians would make is that the image of harmony is very widely used by many writers to indicate, in effect, these things are different, and yet when they come together, they provide something that is A, how should I put it, it's coherent, but it's bigger and better than the originals. In other words, that what you get when you put these things together is bigger and better than the original. Now, you can't really make that point easily using light, and the image of harmony is a very rich one. It allows you to bring divergent perspectives together and say these are different aspects of the whole, just as you might listen to a chord and pick out the individual notes. So I think you're right, there's a lot that can be done there. Also, the image of the voice is very rich, because I have a distinct voice, you have a distinct voice. Think of John 10, you know, using the image of the Good Shepherd, you know, the sheep hear his voice and recognize. I remember actually in Oxford hearing a lecture on this, and the lecturer would say, this is nonsense, you know, what is this all about? And I went home and I said a few words to a friend, and my cat, who was fast asleep about 50 yards away, heard my voice and came running because he was hungry and he recognized my voice. So you can see that has a distinct echo, which you don't really find with images of light. So what I would say is both these sets of images are there in scripture. The Western tradition has tended to prioritize ocular images. We can use both. And I'd want to suggest that both of them actually have a very real place in our thinking about how we articulate and represent the Christian faith. Thank you. The image of pennies dropping is very, very good. I mean, what we're saying is, you know, very often you're looking at something and you don't see what it is, and then something happens, and, you know, suddenly you see something that wasn't there. And I remember this at school when I was talking to my science master. I was about 10. And I was trying to understand something about why it was that when you looked at the planets at night, they seemed to backtrack a bit. I couldn't make sense of it. And I had an observation, but you know, I thought my eyes were deluding me. So I went and said, look, how do I make sense of it? And he told me. And, you know, after that conversation, you know, suddenly the thing made sense. And how do we explain it? I don't know. It's a moment of illumination. You know, that's all I can describe it. And anyone who's had that experience, you're looking at something, you make no sense, and then suddenly something clicks and you see it rightly. You know, it's a psychological question, but nevertheless, there is this issue. I see it like this, I see it like that, and making that transition is so important. Helping people to see, first of all, there are two different ways of looking at things is quite a big step. Helping them to see that the Christian way of looking at things actually might well be right, and if it is right, changes everything, actually is a very big deal. And I think myself, it's something we need to talk about. I remember once I was asked to go and talk at a London church. It was in the business end of town, and this church had a long history of connection with George Herbert. And so I talked about one of Herbert's poems, and this said, look, you guys here, most of you are here because you simply make money. In other words, you generate somebody else's treasure. Then using a line from Herbert, I asked, are you a treasure yourself for anyone? And I had a line of people afterwards who saw that question as being existentially transformative. Once one man said to me, I'm here making money for other people, and I'm not valued myself. And, you know, it was one of those things where just people began to see things in a different way, and I don't know what happened as a result, but certainly I just noted how things seemed different after that. Thank you.
Yes.
Dr. McGrath, what would you recommend to read if we're seeking right now, say we're kind of exploring Christianity? What were some foundational very books for you before you came to faith in Christ?
It's interesting because a lot of the things I read really were things that people just gave me, and I don't really recall exactly what they were. They may have been tracts. I began to read Christianity seriously about 1974, something kind of into my Christian life. But it wasn't really reading anything that actually brought me to conversion. It was much more talking to friends and beginning to realise that A, atheism was evidentially much weaker than I'd thought, and B, Christianity seemed to be much more intellectually illuminating than I'd realised. But that I got mainly from talking to people. And I want to say to you, conversations matter, because you may think I haven't changed this person's mind, but you may have planted seeds that move them on. And that certainly happened to me. The person I began to read was, I'm afraid, C.S. Lewis. In fact, I still have many of my books written by Lewis, which are, in those days I used to just write my name and I would date them, because I didn't have very many books in those days. And actually, I've still got them, and I can tell you exactly which of Lewis's books I wrote at which time, because read at which time. And certainly I found him helpful, as many continue to do so. If I were to be asked today who I'd recommend, I'd actually suggest someone like Tim Keller. I very much like Lewis, but he's kind of way linked with an England that's now gone, and it shows in his vocabulary and examples. And you can explain them, and they make sense, but you need someone, I think, to help you a little bit. Tim Keller just speaks to you. You know, it's like a voice from the Bronx that just hits you. And that's great. So he now would be someone I would write, especially his book, The Question of God, which I think is really very, very good. Thank you.
One of your debates, again, I think it was Christopher Hitchens, but I can't recall it very well. You were talking about the resurrection, and I just wanted to know that, do you think that Jesus bodily resurrected from the dead? And if so, I mean, yes or no, how do you think that affects the Christian message for hope?
Well, on this matter, I just think what the New Testament thought. And your question actually is sort of taking a later debate and using that to read the New Testament. But if I answer the question in terms of your question, then for me, a physical resurrection really does matter. A, because it helps us understand why the witnesses to the resurrection were, they weren't just astonished, they were frightened. You think of the final words of Mark's gospel, Ephubetu gar. That's of the women, because they were afraid. They ran away. In other words, there's just something that they could not take in. And that fits very, very well with, the traditional account of things. The idea of some kind of spiritual resurrection, that Jesus came back to life in the memory of his followers, or, like John Brown, body mouldering, but his spirit lives on. No, that does not account for what we read about in the New Testament. Earlier I talked about, the big picture that makes most sense of things. It's very hard to read the New Testament in the light of a kind of reduced vision of the resurrection. It just doesn't ring true, I'm afraid. What difference does it make? Well, there are lots of differences it makes. Let me just mention one. One is the question of identity. And the question I'm talking about is not so much who I am, although that's interesting, at least to me, and the question of who you are. It's a question of what will we be like in heaven, which is, I know, a long way off, but it's something we ought to be thinking about. And the idea of a physical resurrection is, in effect, about continuity. Yes, we'll be transformed, but there is a continuity between us and them, and now and them. The idea of a purely spiritual resurrection, in my view, rests on a rather Greek way of thinking. There's this mortal body, inside there's an immortal soul. It's not really a very biblical way of thinking. I think that if you look at words like nepesh and so on in Hebrew, they don't really mean that. It's much more this aspect of humanity, the ability of humanity to relate to God. What we find, for example, in Psalm 8, this idea that the relationality between God and humanity is of critical importance, and that is continued. That's very important, I think. So for me, it's actually very important about the Christian hope. It is saying to me, and I may be wrong, but it's saying to me that when I'm in heaven, it's me. It's not I've been absorbed in some infinite ocean. It's me, but with all the blemishes gone. And that to me is very exciting. Let me tell you something which just will probably reinforce many people's vision of theology as being pointless speculation, but here it goes anyway. In the 12th century, there was a massive debate about what people would look like in heaven. And there was agreement that blemishes will be gone, moral or physical. But interestingly, this is the viewpoint that gained the ascendancy. When we are in heaven, we will either look like what we were at 30, or what we would have been had we reached the age of 30. Why? Well, you know the answer. Because Jesus was about 30 when he died. That is therefore the perfect age. So in heaven, we will look... And in fact, if you look at medieval depictions of heaven, people look as if they are about 30.
One more question.
I know it's lazy. I think it's much more that we all need to find a way of thinking that seems to work. And an enigma is not something that you don't think about. It's something you do think about, but you recognize that even though you can't completely resolve it, there's still space for it in some form, perhaps a fuzzy form, inside this panorama of faith. And I mean, there are many ways you could look at this, but if we try to talk about the limits of human reason, something I haven't talked about very much tonight, but I ought to really, I mean, we have to recognize that very often there are some things which are just so big that our minds can't take them in. And very often we're tempted to say, because I can't take it in, it's wrong or it's irrational. Whereas in reality, it's just I can't make sense of this. And certainly, as someone who had to do mathematics because I was a scientist, there came a cut-off point where actually the maths was just too hard for me. And I just said, you know, I can't go in a purely theoretical direction because I just can't grasp this. And it wasn't because it was wrong or irrational. If anything, it was brilliant. It was just that I couldn't cope with it. Or again, I remember once being alone and lost on the Tokyo metro system, confronted by a wall of flashing lights with station names in Japanese, which I don't read. And I remember thinking, look, you know, I need someone to help me here. But I also remember thinking, you know, look, if only I could unlock this, this would make perfect sense. It's just I can't. It's a mystery to me. It's not irrational. It's just I don't have access to it. I think that is an important point. It's not about laziness. It's about a principle recognition that there may be areas that we cannot ultimately resolve. But nevertheless, the picture is so good that we can tolerate a lack of sharp focus in some areas. Now, that seems to me not really about evasion. It's much more a willingness to recognize that under the limiting conditions of this life and under the limiting conditions of our rationality, there are going to be blank spots, fuzzy spots in that panorama. It's not a picture that explains everything, but it's better, in my view, than its alternatives. Thank you.
Thank you. If you all will join me in thanking Professor Graf one more time.